Good afternoon. It is March 10th, 2026. I call this meeting of the Environment and Natural Resource Policy Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Hansen, have you reviewed the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I did review the minutes, and I would move those of March 5th
for approval. Representative Hansen, I move the approval of the March 5th, 2026 minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. We are going to be starting off today with the salt applicator bill, which is House File 793. I know our presenters have other committees that they've got bills up and are being pulled back and forth, seeing we're getting close to deadline. So, Co-Chair Heinzman, would you like to move House File 793 be re-referred to the Judicial Finance and Civil Law Committee?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Co-Chair Heinzman. We have a technical amendment suggested by House Research. I will move the A1 amendment to get to the bill in the shape the author wants. If I remember right, this is just an amendment to change the date to make it current. Any questions on the A1 amendment? All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, and we will now go to, the amendment is approved, we'll now go to House File 793 as amended. Vice Chair Scott, would you like to, excuse me, Chair Representative Scott, would you like to go ahead and present your bill? And I see that you have Representative Hollins with you also.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say we've swapped chief authors on this bill, and I'm happy to take on the bill. And before I get started with the presentation, I just wanted to give Rep. Hollins the opportunity to say a few words as the former author but now co-author.
Why, thank you. Representative Hollins, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Heinzman. Thank you, committee members. I'm really happy to be here co-presenting this critical proposal alongside Chair Scott. I think a lot of us are familiar with this proposal. I've carried it for several years, and with the idea that we need to use less salt and we need to add a limited liability protection to the MPCA's smart salting training and certificate program in order to address the growing threat to Minnesota's lakes, rivers, streams, and ecosystems due to unnecessary salting. So a significant amount of salt is used on private parking lots and sidewalks and is often over-applied. Not because contractors want to misuse salt, but because of the liability concerns if they are not properly salting. This bill addresses that problem by providing limited liability protection to trained and certified salt applicators that can prove that they have still been using the best management practices during snow and ice management. The voluntary certification program teaches applicators how to use the right amount of product at the right time in the right way, reducing unnecessary salt use. Reducing that salt application helps protect Minnesota's water resources, infrastructure, and ecosystems. And by promoting best practices, the program supports long-term water quality improvement while maintaining safe winter conditions. The main reason salt is overapplied is the fear of a slip and fall liability. Contractors often feel pressured to use more salt than necessary to avoid potential lawsuits. This bill brings accountability to all parties and provides limited liability protection for certified applicators who can prove that they follow the approved best practices. This is not immunity, as some people have said previously. They have to prove that they've used the best practices in salt management. This bill does not protect gross negligence, intentional injury, or failure to follow the standards. And certainly, as we're here in Environment Committee, I think it's particularly important that we address salt usage because it impacts every aspect of our lives in the land of 10,000 lakes and also our infrastructure as it corrodes the infrastructure that we use in the metro area as well. And I'll turn it back over to Chair Scott.
Go ahead, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. And I don't have a whole lot to add to that. We all know of the way that excessive chloride pollutes, and so what we want to do with this bill is it's actually the MPCA has already developed the program. It's already being used. And so this is just, having further discussion on that and talking about a ways that you can get this bill across the finish line so that we can get more of these people certified so we aren't over salting. So I think she's kind of outlined a lot of the details, and so I will just I want to also let you know that there's an updated letter that we just received from New Hampshire today, and I think you have the old one in your packets. We have, I don't know where the pages are, but if the page wants to maybe hand out an updated letter, that'd be great, or we'll just, yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I do have a testifier.
Okay, super. Thank you, Representative Scott. We'll go to the first testifier here. We've got 2 minutes for each testifier, as we have a lot of testifiers and other bills today. First person I have on the agenda here is Paulita LaPlante. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paulita LaPlante of Inver Grove Heights. I'm an owner of Prescription Landscape. We're a woman-owned business enterprise founded in 1980, headquartered in St. Paul, Minnesota, with branch offices in Crystal, New Brighton, and Shakopee. I'm here in support of HF 793. Prescription Landscape is a privately held, locally owned commercial landscape company, approximately $40 million in revenues, depending on snowfall totals. We employ a year-round staff of 150 and grow to twice that size in the winter. Salt applicator certification, along with limited liability, are essential to reduce salt usage and its resulting pollution. Importantly, passage of this bill will stimulate discussion among property managers and business owners to adopt snow and ice management plans that mitigate hazards without such a significant and negative impact on our environment. Our corporate stewardship and business philosophy requires that we adhere to best practice management relative to snow and ice. We rely on training and credentialing programs currently provided through professional organizations of which we are members, specifically Accredited Snow Contractors Association, the Snow and Ice Management Association. Our snow and ice staff participate in annual refresher training in the use of salt and brine and best practices in snow and ice removal. Over 100 of our snow managers are level one smart salt certified through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As an organization, we are also level two smart salt certified by MPCA, which means that we monitor and report our performance in minimizing salt use and have done for years to demonstrate that we decrease salt use. All these programs teach us the value of calibrating our equipment, measuring brine and salt, tracking dates of treatment, and receiving current weather reports to ensure that we're making the correct decisions for ice management. These are proven practices that decrease slip and falls and salt use on client properties. We enter into detailed snow and ice contracts with all our clients. The contract includes specifications and scope. Despite being a certified snow professional, it's very challenging for us and expensive to be named a co-defendant in a slip and fall. Because of that, the expenses that we incur are software related. We geofence clients' properties. We use real-time production software to track work, and we are always looking for new ways to train and streamline our services.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I hate to cut you off there, but I want to make sure we get the same time for everybody else, too. Thank you. Next, I have as a testifier, Joel Carlson. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. I've maybe testified on this bill almost as many times as the bill to have school start after Labor Day, which I'm very passionate about. Mr. Chairman and members, everyone agrees with the goal of this bill, which is using less chloride. That is not the issue. The issue is the content of this bill and how it accomplishes that goal. And I will tell you, as an environment committee, there is not a single instance where immunity from liability has reduced contamination. That simply is not going to happen, particularly when you have applicators who get paid by the application and by the pound of product. This bill this year is actually a different iteration from previous attempts. And the voluntary certification here, which doesn't apply to everybody, need only be renewed every 10 years. One person on your firm is all that has to take the training. I've taken the training. It took about 4 hours, and I was a certified salt applicator, although under this bill, my certification would still be current because it has been 10 years. It used to be three. But it is not a rigorous training. And this bill provides absolute immunity for the salt applicator and every building owner in the state who uses one of these applicators from any liability. That just goes too far. We do not provide that protection to any for-profit business in Minnesota in any instance. This is an absolute immunity when they have negligently caused you an injury. I want to comment just briefly on the New Hampshire letter that's in your packet, because it's one of the things that troubles me about this bill. If you look on page 2.29, it talks about the applicator or the owner committing gross negligence, which is not the civil standard. And in Minnesota, that means no care at all. You did nothing. That's what you have to overcome if you've been injured on someone's property where they've invited you onto their property as a business. No care at all. But if you look at, Mr. Chair, I'll go very briefly. If you look at one of the reasons that they can overcome that immunity is if the applicator didn't comply with the requirements of this bill. Look what New Hampshire said. They had a case, one case, and New Hampshire said the plaintiff tried to challenge that they didn't comply with the requirements. And New Hampshire said in their letter, they said that that is simply not achievable, desired. What is their term?
Mr. Carlson, we're past
time. I'm sorry. I couldn't see with my glasses on, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
In New Hampshire.
Give him a good elbow there, Representative Scott.
It's not expected, achievable, or realistic to comply with the requirements of this bill. That's what happened. Mr. Okay. Chairman,
Thank
this
you.
Bill is not ready for prime time. We have no idea what the fiscal costs are. And we have no idea what
Thank
the
you.
Cost shifts are to people that are injured through someone else's negligence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Next, I have Erica, and please forgive me if I get your pronunciation wrong here. Snigowiski?
We're going to find out.
Go ahead and introduce yourself and who you're with, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Erica Snigowski, and I serve as the administrator for the Nine Mile Creek Watershed District, a local unit of government with communities in the Southwest Twin Cities Metro, and we work to protect and improve water resources throughout the Nine Mile Creek Watershed. Our district manages land and water resources that drain to Nine Mile Creek and the Minnesota River. One of the most persistent water quality challenges we face is chloride pollution from winter de-icing salt. Chloride is a permanent pollutant. It does not break down in the environment, and it accumulates in our water resources. Across Minnesota, dozens of lakes and streams are already impaired for chloride, and those numbers continue to grow. In our watershed, we have invested significant time and public resources working with cities, private contractors, property managers, and state partners to reduce salt use. The Watershed District supports smart salting training and other education efforts that help applicators maintain public safety while reducing environmental impacts from chloride. Because of this work, we strongly support policies that encourage responsible salt use and expanded participation in certified applicator training. However, we do have a few concerns with House File 793 in its current form. Watershed organizations across Minnesota have supported limited protection from liability for certified applicators who follow established best management practices. But to be effective, that certification must be grounded in the existing Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Smart Salting Program, which already provides science-based training and oversight. Dispersing authority to manage the certification framework risks undermining program consistency and accountability. We also believe certification should occur on a regular renewal cycle, ideally every 3 years, to ensure applicators stay current with evolving best practices and technology. In short, we support the goal of encouraging responsible salt application, but we ask the committee to revise the bill to rely on the existing Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Smart Salting Program and ensure meaningful certification standards by requiring recertification every 3 years.
We're at time. Thank you. Next, I have Alexis Donath. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 793. For the record, my name is Alexis Donath. I serve as Assistant Director of Government Relations at the MPCA. Chloride is a major water quality concern in Minnesota. More than 20 water bodies are already listed on the impaired waters list for chloride, and many other water bodies show increasing levels of chloride. MPCA shares the author's goals to reduce chloride pollution at the source by incentivizing smart salting practices. The MPCA has offered smart salting courses for many years in an effort to help state, county, city, and private salt applicators reduce their environmental impact while achieving materials costs by using de-icing salt efficiently and effectively. We certify around 1,500 applicators per year and offer about 60 courses per year focused on a number of different audiences and have generally received very positive feedback on the effectiveness of these courses. In our review of the bill, we identified a few modifications that would ensure that it's able to achieve the author's goals. For example, we would note that locking in a specific course registration fee into statute might be the right dollar amount now, but perhaps not the right dollar amount into the future. We've already started discussing some of these pieces with stakeholders, and we're happy to work with Representative Scott on the bill going forward. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we're happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing or hearing anyone, questions from members. Co-Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just start out by thanking Representative Scott and Representative Hollins for collaborating on this bill. This has been around for a long time, members. I thought that I might have even carried it at one point, but Ms. Zipko just confirmed that I've just been a co-author, apparently. It's been 11 years, so, I mean, at some point you start to forget here and there what bills you authored and co-authored. No, I just am super supportive of the language. I see so much bipartisan collaboration around the table on this, and this is a great committee for that. Chair Fisher and I are always working towards those goals, and in this case, I think the testimony I heard early on really said it best. This problem is never going to go away, and unless we address it sooner than later, we're only going to exacerbate the problem down the road. Chloride doesn't just disappear or evaporate out of water. I'm not going to go there, but we hope that this bill has a path going forward. I'm concerned that it doesn't, but I'm not going to suggest that we quit. So my best wishes to the bill authors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions for the author. One is on the training, and you know, in previous years as this has gone through, I've raised concerns about sole source training and for certification and licensing. And we have to use a different model with the pesticide applicator training. We have the university, a different third party that may approve training, and then the licensing is done by the regulatory agency. So you can have a variety of training opportunities or method. And so I'm just concerned of locking in a sole source training. I know we've had testimony on both sides of that issue, but in terms of competition, what are your thoughts on that with training into the future?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I'm open to going either way. I just want to get this across the finish line. I see value in both. I mean, the MPCA, they do the science. And I will say, too, that the program has become much more rigorous in the past few years. It's you know, it was kind of alluded to in prior testimony that this was, you know, a relatively easy thing to do, but it has become a more rigorous course, and that's the right thing to do. And so I'm open to whatever the stakeholders think is the best course of action on whether to keep all the training at the MPCA or to, you know, to have other area, other entities that can offer that same training. And I'm also open on how many years the certification is for. So, yeah.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with certification and licensing, occupational licensing, we have a lot of places where we have occupational licensing. And the certification is to demonstrate, for the applicant to demonstrate a minimum competency. It's the minimum threshold that the applicator is competent to do that. My concern is if we set the precedent on the limited liability exemption for salt applicators, that then the precedent is there for pesticide applicators, for sewage applicators, for a variety of other where we have a minimum competency occupational measurement. So how do we prevent that if we break that seal?
Representative Scott.
And I'm happy to have Representative Hollins answer the question if it's different than mine, but I think that's for this body to decide going forward. It just is.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hansen, for the question. I think I actually agree. No, shouldn't say actually. I agree with Representative Scott. I think that this there are many different processes that we control within the legislature, and it is absolutely within our purview to decide when doing that certification reaches to a level that alleviates that liability, right? And so it's something that we have to choose carefully when we want to do it. And I think any bill that we have at any point also, you know, we are, it's incumbent upon us to review those things over time, right? If we pass this bill and people take the certification program and we expect salt usage to go down, that is something that we should be checking in on periodically, because we need to know that it's actually doing the thing we want it to do and not just reducing liability with no actual benefit to the environment. And I think it's incumbent upon us as legislators that are making state laws to be doing that oversight and also to be controlling when and how we reduce liability. So I see what you're saying, that there's a potential for creating precedent, but I think that we aren't judges, we aren't in a courthouse. Our precedent doesn't have to extend to the next certification process that comes forward.
Okay, thank you. And then next I have Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Hansen's question, I know before I worked here, the curriculum for the smart salting was proprietary to MPCA, so I don't know if this is a question for MPCA or for bill authors, but wondering about the availability for other folks to become trainers and to actually have this be more widespread and available to Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott, would that be you? You'd like to take first crack?
I don't know,
at?
But we could have our testifier from the MPCA come forward, and she can sure answer that question.
Okay. Welcome back, Ms. Stone. I want you to go ahead and take a shot at answering the question there.
Mr. Chair and Representative Purcell, I would be happy to follow up with our staff to determine the answer to your question. I'm not certain about that at this time.
Representative Purcell. All right. Not seeing any others. The comment I want to say is thank you for the work that you folks have done on this. I would encourage you to take a look at, instead of it being a 10-year recertification is narrowing that back down to maybe three. I think that would be very helpful. And with that, I don't see any further discussion. Any closing comments, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Chair Fisher. No, thank you for the conversation and the good questions, and we'll just continue to work on this bill.
Okay, very good. With that, Co-Chair Heintzman renews his motion that House File 793, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. folks are off and running. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will move on to our next bill. We are heading off to House File 3793. This is Vice Chair Purcell. Would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Purcell moves her bill before the committee. House File 793 is before us. Vice Chair Purcell, if you'd like to go ahead and explain your bill. And then we do have a long list of testifiers, and so we'll probably have a timer that's a little bit louder for the two-minute section when we get to that. So, Representative Purcell, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As is my custom, I like to bring folks up to the testifying table. So in speaking to folks about water in 2026, invariably the issues around data centers crops up. And when speaking to folks about data centers, there isn't much of a middle ground. Some communities are desperate to have a data center, and others are vehemently against it. This bill before us responds to a problematic trend in Minnesota. Large industrial users of Minnesota's groundwater often use municipal water supply to meet their water demand. And rather than apply for their own permit to pump, they go onto the municipality's permit. So one example I'd like to share from my neck of the woods, a data center proposed in Farmington might use 900 million gallons of water per year and plans to get that water through the city's permit rather than their own. That would effectively double the city's water consumption. With a separate permit, the municipality could choose to cut off these industrial users of water before household uses so that their town's growth potential wouldn't be stifled. House File 3793 defines large volume commercial and industrial water users to include all commercial and industrial uses of water that exceed 100 million gallons of water per year. This definition encompasses hyperscale data centers as well as other large volume users, potentially like bottled water plants. The bill aims to increase public transparency and permit scrutiny in three key ways. One, it creates a separate permit requirement for large volume industrial users, which makes it more straightforward to enforce the state's water allocation priority hierarchy if Minnesota finds itself in a time of water shortage. State law prioritizes domestic water supply first and industrial at a much lower priority. Number two, it creates mandatory public comment period for large volume industrial water permits so the public can weigh in on whether these proposals used are sustainable now and into the future. And number three, it increases transparency about industrial water use and its aquifer impacts. It requires large volume users to report their water use to the DNR monthly instead of annually. And if an aquifer pump test is conducted, the results may be included in any environmental review for the proposed projects. I hope we'll be able to lay the bill over as I commit to this body, the agency, co-authors on the bill, and community partners that there is still work to be done on this bill, and have even started working with the nonpartisan staff to work on a few of those things already. So happy to continue that work to find a workable solution, because we know hyperscale data centers are here. And if or when the time of water shortages come, Minnesotans need to be able to prioritize how we use the precious resource of fresh water. And for that, Mr. Chair, I welcome testifiers.
Very good. Thank you, Co-Vice Chair Purcell. First person I have is Janelle Kuznia. If you'd like to come forward, introduce yourself, who you're with, and you'll have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Fisher and Heinzman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 3793. My name is Janelle Kuzna, and I live in New Market Township near Elkle New Market in Scott County. Like many of my neighbors, my family relies on private well for drinking water. In fact, in the state of Minnesota, nearly 1.2 million citizens rely on private wells for drinking water. In 2022, a large water bottling facility made application with the City of Elko New Market and requested 165 million gallons of water per year, which was more than the entire city was using at the time. After intense community advocating, the DNR required an aquifer pump test to see how this increase would affect local surface water features, the local aquifer, and private wells in the area. During this pump test, several private wells in the area began to have problems: out of water complaints, black and brown water, clogged filters, and damaged appliances. 68 people filed complaints at the time, but subsequently hundreds have come forward with problems. The city has since conceded that the excess pumping during the pump test most likely caused our well problems. Groundwater pumping does not only affect how much water is in the aquifer, it can cause, can also change quality by mobilizing natural occurring contaminants like manganese and arsenic. Despite these issues, the permit was issued to the city with quality and quantity response plan, making the city responsible, not the industrial user, for investigating well interference, covering the costs, and enforcing statutory priority. This places small local governments in the position of regulating groundwater systems they are not equipped to manage. Minnesota is clear about water priority under Minnesota Statute 103G.261. Domestic use has the first priority, while industrial users fall near the bottom of the priority list. The intent is simple. People's drinking water should come before industrial use. But in practice, large industrial users can obtain water through municipal permits, effectively bypassing the spirit of that priority system. When this happens, the risk shifts onto cities and residents, and private well owners are no longer first priority.
We're at time.
This has had a huge impact on my community, where there's nearly 3,000 private wells. We can no longer allow large industrial users to hide behind municipal permits. Groundwater is a shared public resource, and it's not unlimited. I urge you to pass House File 3793 and close the loophole. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Jim Berg. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you'd like to please introduce yourself, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Berg. I'm a mostly retired hydrogeologist and here as a concerned citizen. As a 37-year veteran of investigating, mapping, and monitoring groundwater as a hydrogeologist, I've lived through a few cycles of operating in relative obscurity only to be jolted into the spotlight by too much rain, too little rain, or the appearance of new water-intensive industries. Several years ago, the challenge was new ethanol plants proposed in locations with meager groundwater supplies. Today, the challenge is hyperscale data centers and their request to consume enormous amounts of groundwater for cooling. 30 years ago, I began my career as a DNR hydrogeologist and learned some very encouraging things about my home state. Minnesota is a riparian rights state. Everyone owns the water. There is no such thing as water rights that can be bought or sold in such a system. People in water-dependent ecosystems have the first priority if ever there are conflicts due to limited supply. Irrigation, power production, and industrial commercial categories are all subordinate uses. To me, these two concepts form a kind of groundwater bill of rights. I was proud to present those ideas to audiences whenever appropriate in my many groundwater investigation presentations that I made over the years. During my DNR career, my job was mostly in the mapping and monitoring part of state government, so my views about the management question before us, HF 3793, are those of an informed citizen and not a retired management professional. But from the mapping and monitoring perspective, I have a firsthand understanding of the threats posed by high volume groundwater usage to Minnesota's largest aquifers and sensitive water-dependent biological resources. Recently, I've become concerned about hyperscale data centers and the shell games that some of the world's largest and richest companies are playing to access vast amounts of water to cool their computers in secret. Last year at the Minnesota Groundwater Association Spring Conference, I listened with great disappointment to a story from a citizen group about a hyperscale data center in Farmington.
We're at time.
Hiding its purpose.
If you could give us a last wrap up there, please.
I support the passage of HF 3793 and believe that it is a necessary modification of Minnesota statutes to help prevent overuse and improper use of Minnesota groundwater resources.
Thank you. Next, I have Sarah Mora-Dean. If you'd like to come forward, please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, Chair Heinzman, committee members. My name is Sarah Moradian. I'm the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE, a rurally based nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and restoring resilient communities and landscapes by harnessing the power of the people who care. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in strong support of House File 3793 today. As you know, you passed a handful of laws last year aiming to address some of the concerns around hyperscale data center development in our state. These laws are a floor, not a ceiling. One issue that remains unresolved is that of water. Last year's laws do not establish an enforceable reporting requirement for data centers' actual water use. The law states that the DNR may request pre-application information from a data center if that data center contacts the DNR. If a data center triggers a permit threshold, the law provides a list of things the DNR shall ensure, most of which are already required under existing law. And the new language regarding water use and efficiency in that section is not enforceable. The result is language that does little to protect Minnesota's water and communities from the unique impacts of hyperscale data centers. Water is a major concern for the public, as hyperscale data centers' water use can be significant, depending on the type of cooling system used and the type of electricity generation powering the data center. For example, according to documents obtained through a Data Practices Act request to the Department of Natural Resources, Amazon's proposed facility in Becker could use as much as 1.8 billion gallons of water per year once fully built out. According to those same documents, Amazon had also been in discussions with the city of Becker about potentially adding the company's wells to the city's water supply infrastructure. This exposes the major loophole that Representative Purcell identified earlier in current law, which could allow hyperscale data centers to obtain their water directly from municipal sources without a clear opportunity for public engagement or full agency review of the potential impacts of such appropriations. Requiring the largest water users to apply for their own permit and reporting the actual amount of water used are important steps towards ensuring that there are adequate resources available and that members of the public have the opportunity to weigh in on proposed projects and the impacts they might have on our shared water resources. For these reasons, we urge you to support House File 3793. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Mo Fishami. I'm saying that. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mo Fishami, and my professional background as a telecommunication engineer and data center network designer for several Fortune 500 companies, some in Minnesota. I'm here to share my personal experience in support of HF 3793. I live in proximity of a proposed data center in Farmington. When fully operational on a summer day, this will use more water than a city of 22,000 people would use on an average day. After reviewing the project AUAR, DNR sent a letter of concern to the city, warning them about the significant water demand. 2 months after that warning, Farmington signed a contract with the developer that would guarantee them 2.93 million gallons of water per day. They also, by doing so, have obligated the city to make sure that that water is provided, not having yet even applied and gotten permission from DNR to bump their allotment. What Farmington is doing is not unique. It's a common practice by most, if not all, cities that are hosting hyperscale data centers. This will force the capital cost of increased water and sewer capacity onto the citizens of the city. That has happened in Farmington already. The practice of cities supplying data centers out of their own domestic water can also circumvent the water prioritization statute. These large data centers can then, by using the water from the city, jump the line from priority 5 to priority 1 and ahead of farmers' litigation, irrigation, and power generators even. So I get it that Minnesota, we should be a new business-friendly state, but we also need to protect our environment. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next, I have Joy Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. You have 2 minutes. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, Chair Heinzman, members of the committee. My name is Joy Anderson, and I'm an attorney with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Right now, 50% of the United States is in drought conditions, and the U.S. Forest Service says that there's going to be water shortages across the United States in coming years. This means that industries that are water intensive are looking to Minnesota because we have water resources here. They look to this as a place where water resources can still be exploited. But our resources are not unlimited, as you know from DNR talking to you several weeks ago. Pumping too much groundwater can cause residential wells to dry up. It can draw contaminants like manganese and arsenic into water, as Ms. Kuzna was talking about, and it can long-term threaten sustainable water supplies. We are especially concerned with this trend of large water users getting their water through city permits. For example, Dakota County is the site of several data center proposals that could double the amount of water a city consumes. In Elko Newmarket, a bottled water plant already amended the city's appropriation for water, and it's planning to do so again. This bill provides three common sense changes that will increase scrutiny for large volume industrial users. It creates a separate permit requirement so that the state's water allocation priorities, which do favor domestic water, can be enforced more easily. It requires a comment period so the public can weigh in on proposed water usage in their communities, which they are missing when this gets put underneath a municipal permit. And it requires large industrial users to report their monthly water use to DNR and to include aquifer pump test information in environmental review so that everyone is making informed decisions about what water is being used and what the effects will have in their community. Because these changes will help protect Minnesota's limited groundwater resources from unscrutinized exploitation by industrial-scale water users, I ask you to support HF 3793. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you for your time. Next, I have Andrew Morley. If you'd like to come forward, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes for your presentation.
Co-Chair Fisher, Co-Chair Heinzman, my name is Andrew Morley, and I work for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you to the committee and Representative Purcell for the chance to testify today in opposition to HF 3793, a bill that creates a new permitting requirement for commercial applications, among other provisions. Under this bill, a data center project must give notice to every municipality in its same U.S. Geological Survey Unit code. That means a data center proposal near the Twin Cities Metro would have to notify every municipality through the upper Midwest Mississippi region, which includes parts of neighboring states, but also towns in Missouri and southern Illinois, more than 600 miles away. This would be a massive undertaking for the DNR, consuming significant full-time employee hours and financial resources. It would make compliance for the agency next to impossible and make more litigation a certainty. Just 9 months ago, the legislature approved a set of statutes governing data center permitting, taxation, and more. In that new law, the DNR has the authority to request pre-application information from data centers, including water use plans, sources, temperatures, and averages, among other items. And most relevant to this discussion, under Statute 103G271, the legislature directs the DNR commissioner to require applicants conduct aquifer tests to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. This was a compromise bill that received significant support from both caucuses in the House and was signed by the governor. Before creating duplicative or unnecessary compliance requirements for the project proposers in the MPCA, we believe the newly passed environmental protections for data center development should be followed. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Peter Wiginius. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself, you have 2 minutes for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wiginius, Legislative Director at Sierra Club, and thank you to Representative Purcell for offering this important bill. Why is Minnesota an attractive place for big tech to locate hyperscale data centers? The first reason is obviously the massive subsidies the state provides for Minnesota taxpayers. But the second reason is our waters. Using our waters to cool their hyperscale data centers can save big tech owners huge amounts compared to air cooling with electricity. The owners want massive amounts of drinking quality water because it's the cheapest way to cool. Others have noted that a separate DNR permit is needed to ensure residential customers are the priority. But that's not the only reason. The expert staff at DNR need to be involved, even if the people they answer to don't think that's needed, because cities are not equipped to deal with big tech behemoths. And the cities are not charged with protecting aquifer, DNR is. Our water resources, both surface water and groundwater, do not follow municipal boundaries. A broader perspective and the expertise that comes with it are necessary. Furthermore, we have an incentive problem. cities are going to look at data centers as a way to raise revenue. But the gap between the size of a big tech owner of a hyperscale data center and a municipality in Minnesota can hardly be overstated. It is a chasm. That small municipality could sell water at many times the rate they charge to residential customers, and the city could feel like it's a great deal for them. But it would still be a small cost to the hyperscaler compared to the cost of cooling without our water. This is why it is virtually impossible to create an effective financial incentive for water conservation through the water bill. Water consumption itself needs to be directly regulated to protect Minnesota's resources. This is DNR's responsibility, and we need to make them take their responsibilities seriously without any excuses. If there's a cost associated with a separate permit, make the proposer pay for it. The owners are the richest people in human history who can afford it. The state needs to strictly limit the amount of drinking water, quality water that data centers can use to protect our waters for future generations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, I have Eleanor Dolan.
On Zoom?
We're not seeing him on Zoom at the moment. Next, we'll go to the next person then. Jenna Van Den Boom, and they are on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce your name, please, and begin your testimony, you have 2 minutes. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Hello, my name is Jenna Van Den Boom, and I'm from Monticello, Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of the Stop the Monticello Data Centers Group. Thank you for allowing me the time to testify today. Monticello is a community of approximately 16,000 residents, and we're located roughly halfway between Minneapolis and St. Cloud on Interstate 94 in the Mississippi River. Our group consists of over 1,100 members, and we continue to grow daily. The goal of our group is to put a pause on hyperscale data centers in Minnesota until regulations to provide the necessary protections for building something as impactful as hyperscale data centers are implemented. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 3793. This legislation is important to me because the hyperscale data center boom in Minnesota, and specifically Monticello, pose additional threats to the Mississippi River, now labeled as the most endangered river in the U.S., and our local aquifers. We currently have two hyperscale data center proposals for Monticello, one of which is a 3 million square foot hyperscale data center on 550 acres of what is currently mainly farmland. If the proposed hyperscale data center goes through, it would roughly double the amount of water currently being pulled from our aquifer. That's not taking into account the amount of indirect water used or the second proposed hyperscale data center. We currently have people in Monticello that already don't have access to clean drinking water, high levels of manganese in our water, and our aquifers are already vulnerable as the tritium leak from the Monticello nuclear plant has already displayed. This issue is putting city governments at significant odds with their constituents as they determine how to independently navigate this uncharted territory. Monticello city government has repeatedly questioned its ability to create and enforce rules that exceed that of the state government. I understand the concept of wanting cities to maintain the autonomy to act independent of stringent government oversight, but that being said, we have cities from all over the state represented here, and the decisions made here pose significant ramifications for all Minnesotans. It's important to note that if left in city government hands alone, when all these hyperscale data centers get passed, the scale of ramifications will be felt not just across our state, but also across the entire country. We need to implement measures that hold large industrial water users accountable by requiring them to have their own permits, monthly tracking, and allow for public comment as we are the first line of defense. Continuing to leave these decisions in the hands of individual cities without the guardrails necessary for guidance is irresponsible and has had a significant impact on our current situation. That's why I'm asking you to support House File 3793. Thank you for your time and consideration. I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your availability. Next, I will go to Jason Meckel from the DNR. If you'd like to go ahead and begin your testimony, we'll start off with 2 minutes. I'm going to imagine there's probably many questions that are going to come to you. So you have a lot of the technical expertise, so a little latitude here for you. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Chair Heintzman, for the opportunity to testify here today. For the record, Jason Meckel, Assistant Division Director, Ecological and Water Resources at the DNR. Just a few comments to share. As Representative Purcell had mentioned, we've We've talked about some language in the bill that we think could use some clarifying. It would help us better understand what's being asked of us. I did want to call your attention to a couple of parts just from our perspective and understanding, and that is the what this bill is introducing is a sort of a sub-permittee kind of category here. So we have a municipality who's the permittee, and now we'll have an industrial or commercial user that would be a, they'd have their own individual permit, but they're also underneath the permit of the municipality. We think that introduces some complexities that we're still trying to wrap our minds around and how we would manage that and what that would mean. But we think it definitely means we would need to change the way our permitting structure is administered and also some IT investment to facilitate that to work. The other thing I wanted to point out is that, as written, the 30-day public comment period on a draft permit will add, we think, between 60 and 90 days to our permit timeline reviewing these complex and large appropriation permits. And I think it was mentioned earlier about the public comments. We do not have a system for managing that kind of a public comment period or volume of information, and we think we're going to have to invest in some sort of a platform to help us to do that. We are working on the fiscal note that I think is due at the end of this week, so you all will have that soon, and we're happy to work with the author as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. With that, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? I see a person on my left over here. If you'd like to come forward. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and you've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Heinzman, and members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Won't need my 2 minutes. Just wanted to come up here to say that we have been discussing how this bill works with the author. I would agree with the testimony the DNR just gave that while it's a potentially useful idea, it doesn't work within the type of permitting we currently do and would need some work so that we can not have a permit within a permit where things can end up being double counted or double enforced, and it's very difficult to decide who's the problem if there is a problem. So we'd like to continue to work with the author on coming up with solutions that would work without having to create entirely new permit systems to do that if possible. So appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Is there anyone else that would care to testify? I see a person in the back. Hi, if you'd like to come to the table over here. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce who you are, and you have 2 minutes for your testimony.
Thanks, I'll be short. I'm Tina Clark. I live here in St. Paul. I just wanted to share an experience living in Western Massachusetts when Nestle wanted to build a water bottling plant in my little town. And it turned out that legally, once a contract was signed with Nestle, we lost as citizens and our local government lost a fair amount of authority because in the court, we would have signed a contract that would have put Nestle's grab of our local water ahead of farmers, local businesses, residents, industrial processes, our own, we had some environmental fish, what do you call them, nurseries. And it was a real shock. So I just wanted to ask that members of the committee fully understand that the state fully understand what kinds of authority a contract such as a, you know, could pose problems for all of us restraining access to that water, especially in times of drought or when there's water contamination from other sources such as the millions of underground oil and gas storage leaking facilities, that we need a reserve beyond what we might think we need. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify? Not seeing any, I will close testimony at this time and open up to members. First person on the agenda for questions or comments would be Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this bill forward to begin this discussion. As written, I understand that this would not include large water users from the agriculture industry. And I guess I would just ask, you know, where are you in the process of potentially, you know, adding that as a classification of large water users? What all would be involved in that process as well? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm open to that, as this, with all the feedback that I'm getting today and have gotten and will continue to get. That might be a DNR question if Mr. Meckel is able to answer that.
Mr. Meckel, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Could you repeat the question as far as, I didn't quite catch all the details.
Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meckel. So I was wondering if I know there have been some discussions, because currently, as bill is written, excludes large water users from the agriculture industry, and I was curious if there had been discussions surrounding potentially adding large water agricultural users from the agriculture industry to be covered within this bill language. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Gottfried. So to clarify, I think you're talking about agricultural industry that uses more than 100 million gallons.
Okay, that's correct.
I'm not aware of any discussion specific to including those uses. What I can tell the committee and here in the audience is that we issue roughly 50 to 60 permits annually that are 100 million gallons or more, or involve an amendment to a permit that has 100 million gallons or more. So many of those are municipalities, but there are some agricultural industries that do use over 100 million gallons of water annually. The total number that we estimated under the commercial and industrial sector of those uses is 20 to 30. Our current total is 50 to 60. It fluctuates each year. So that gives you some sense of the number of permits that would be in that scope.
Representative Gottfried.
No, thank you for that answer, and thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate it, and I appreciate the, you know, this conversation around like what a large water user is. The reason I ask about that is, you know, if we're evaluating large water users and those permits and stuff, I personally feel like from a fairness standpoint, we should be talking about all industries equally. I think we've had many conversations in the past, and I think as early as last week, that, you know, fresh water is our most precious natural resource that we have in this state. And I firmly believe that we need to be not just thinking about the fresh water supply that we have now, but fresh water supplies that we are going to have in the future. And, you know, while, you know, there's still clearly work that needs to be done in this bill from a technical aspect, you know, I really appreciate starting this conversation, because we need to be having a serious conversation about planning for our future as a state and how we continue to provide for future generations of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment?
Go ahead, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my recollection of our water prioritization statute, I believe agriculture is higher up than commercial industrial, so I do think that's an important piece to have in the conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay, next I have Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Quick question for Vice Chair Purcell. Just curious, looking at line 1.1, you reference data centers in particular, and then on the next page, and I think this goes to Representative Gottfried's question too. I'm curious, on 2.5, you talk about industrial, commercial, consumptive use. Is this directly, specifically designed? Because if you go down to 2.8, we're looking at exceeds the annual amount to 50% or more of a municipality's current authorized annual appropriation. And in the context of agriculture, we'd like to think about irrigation and things, but keep in mind that a lot of ag processing food facilities used a lot of water. I know in our industry in particular, there's situations where a small town might, or small city might have a million to a million and a half gallons worth of water used daily, and a medium-sized processor might use half of that, mm-hmm. and fall into that realm. So from a food safety standpoint, I know we're concerned about water use, but this kind of general language concerns me about the food safety aspect of how much water is necessary to meet the requirements at USDA and others. Could you comment on that?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Burkle. As I said, still working on this, would love to work with you to get some comfort language around making sure that we are looking at these kind of large-scale industrial, particularly the hyperscale data centers, but, you know, as we heard, water bottling plants, et cetera. So, yes, would welcome collaboration on that. Thanks.
Okay. Next, I have Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think it's ironic. It's National Groundwater Awareness Week this week, and so talking about water use, you know, and in talking with our peers around the country and other states, this fever is going on in every state. Mm-hmm. States are being pitted against each other. Communities within states are being pitted against each other with this desire to achieve, you know, maybe it's a gold rush, maybe it's a cold water rush, essentially to get the resource. We have water, we don't have oil, you know, and we drink water, we don't drink oil. We warm that water and dispose of it, and we're affecting a resource that has taken hundreds of years and some thousands of years in some cases. Just so we can watch the new AI memes here. I mean, the people who come after us will look at this moment and say, what were they doing? What were they possibly doing here to think that this would be a better use of our resources? So I appreciate what you're doing, Representative Purcell. It's really hard when you're in a small community and you may be struggling and looking at for new economic opportunity, but the cost of this, we haven't even considered the cost, the price of this water for us and for those that follow after us.
Any comment, Vice Chair? Okay. And then Co-Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fisher. So just a clarification, and it does look, Representative Purcell, like this is specifically addressing groundwater, but is there any reference to confirming that in the bill?
Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe, like on page 331, that's like referencing the groundwater statute, I believe, is 103G. We can ask Ms. Taylor for that, and I know there was some clarification around what statutes to reference in conversation with the DNR, so maybe Ms. Taylor can answer that.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and members, the way I am reading this, and I didn't draft it, so I don't know what the intent was, but it's talking about all water use permits, so to me that would include both groundwater and surface water.
Okay. I'll be right there in just a second. I saw that Jason Meckel had raised their hand to comment on it. Am I correct?
Yes.
Please go ahead, Mr. Meckel.
I was just going to clarify, that's our read too, is that this applies to all water resources. Although I will say, in practicality, data centers aren't interested in our surface water because it's too warm in the summer to use for cooling. So now that's a data center.
It's not
other commercial industrial uses, you know, it might be a surface water source, right? So just share that.
Okay, thank you. Chair Hansen. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we do need to kind of narrow that down, figure that out. And the example that came to my mind, because I recently toured out at Prairie Island, the nuclear power plant there, if I'm getting good data, just doing a quick search, uses 630,000 gallons a minute or 907 million gallons a day in their cooling towers. I don't know if there's any other examples like that out there. The other thought that occurred to me when we're talking about water use, and this, you know, for myself and for anybody that's following along in this discussion. It's kind of hard to have it. Maybe we need a more broad conversation about it. Like, for example, the Prairie Island one, the Prairie Island example, that water is taken in and immediately discharged, right? And the permit regulates the temperature that the water can be discharged at and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of rules. But the water's going in the facility and then immediately right back out. Mm-hmm. So is the water technically being used? Yeah. But sometimes I think what comes to mind when we talk about water use is, like, you drink a bottle of water, you think of it almost as disappearing, right, or what have you, you perspire or whatnot. Or if it's used in some other way, the water's gone, similar to consuming, you know, a gallon of oil or something. It's just an interesting and challenging conversation, and I hope that we get it right as we're kind of trying to figure out data centers and other uses. And sometimes I think it can be very confusing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Not seeing any other comments, going to Vice Chair Purcell, would you have any closing comments?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all the testifiers. Thank you to everyone chiming in. I already feel like ideas are percolating in ways to make this bill better, clearer, and happy to continue that work going forward. So thank you so much for the time, and I really appreciate this. Feels like this was a very constructive, hopefully you all feel a constructive use of our committee time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. And with that, Vice Chair Purcell renews her motion that House File 3793 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. With that, we will go on to House File 3699, which is a Gottfried proposal. Representative Gottfried, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 3699 be placed on the general register.
Okay, very good. Representative Gottfried, I believe you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the DE1 amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, I would like to move the DE amendment. This amendment basically substantively keeps the bill the same, just adds a time certain by which the contest would be finalized and a design chosen, as well as add some requirements that the design has to be made by a Minnesota artist and cannot use artificial intelligence to create that. For the purposes of this bill, we did not feel that it was necessary to define artificial intelligence for this. So that is my amendment.
Okay. Any questions for the author on the amendment? Not seeing any. All in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Nays? Motion is approved, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. With that, we will go to the bill as amended. Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 3699 is trying to really address two things. One is to tie up some loose ends as it pertains to a license plate contest that was established in 2024 by Representative Rick Hansen in one of the laws there. And then also to celebrate our state gemstone, the Lake Superior Agate. There is a lot of agate heads out there, so to speak, that I think would love to have this gemstone on the plate. Huge shout outs to Lars here, a constituent of mine who brought this idea to me, and who will definitely speak more to why this is an awesome idea. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you would please, I will hand it over to my constituent, Lars.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gottfried. Lars Leafland, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you, Representative Gottfried. I'm so grateful to be with all of you. My name is Lars Leafblad. I'm a resident of Shoreview, small business co-owner and lifelong fan of Minnesota State Gemstone, Lake Superior Agate, which was given its official designation after much debate and an advocacy campaign by your legislative predecessors in 1969, signed into law by Governor Lavender. And like many Minnesotans, my first memories of hunting for agates were made on the beaches of Lake Superior with my late grandparents, Jack and Sally Burke, who made Duluth their home after U.S. Steel brought them to town in 1971. I've continued the tradition of agate hunting with my four kids, now ages 13 to 21, via trips to Grand Marais, the banks of the Mississippi, and lakes all around our state. I'm here today in support of House File Number 3699 to amend existing legislation, as Representative Gottfried noted, to clarify that this license plate design contest must celebrate the North Shore and the Lake Superior agate. Why vote yes? 150,000 Minnesotans are members of Lake Superior Agate Facebook groups. This is true. There is a large and very vibrant rockhound community across our state that seek to collect, trade, and share ideas about this state gemstone. Thousands of Minnesotans gather every summer for the Super Bowl of our state gemstone, Moose Lake Agate Days in Moose Lake. And tens of thousands have driven past MAGIC, the Moose Lake Agate and Geological Interpretive Center in Moose Lake State Park, that was opened in 2004 thanks to the work of Phil Gotch, the Minnesota Mineral Club, and again, many of your legislative predecessors. By voting yes on this legislation, you're voting to support a geological catalyst for cross-generational memory making and community building across our state. Thank you for your consideration, for your public service, and your dedication to keep Minnesota rocking. You can find more at agateplate.com. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any, we will move to comments and questions from the members. Is there any comments or questions? Not seeing any. Representative Gottfried, any closing comments?
This is a highly uncontroversial bill that's going to do some fun things, tie a loose end, and celebrate our state gemstone. I would encourage a yes vote to refer it to the General Register. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottfried renews their motion that House File 3699, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. House File 3699, as amended, will be forwarded to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we are moving on to our final bill for the day. I have got House File 3322, Representative Franson. I just saw her here. We will give her a second. And I see we have a co-presenter here, also Representative Hansen. This is another bipartisan bill coming before us here. So we will give a second to have Representative Franson join us. So we'll take about a minute or so break as we hunt her down.
I think Representative Gottfried should have provided agates.
Oh, that's right. Sample agates would have been nice. Representative Franson, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today.
I'm sure you're all joyed.
I'm looking forward to it. I will move House File 3322 before the committee. I do know that we have an author's amendment, so I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Franson, to your bill, and I see you also have Representative Hansen with you. So yeah. Go ahead and start off.
Thank you. Today is a historic day. We have a Franson-Hansen bill. So good afternoon, Chair Fisher, Chair Heintzman, and members of this committee. And you're probably wondering why I'd author a bill like this. Well, I'm the co-chair of Capital Investment, and for the past number of years, I have heard countless stories on the aging water infrastructure needs across the state. And as I'll discuss, the bonding bill may no longer be the right place. Well, it is the right place to do it. We just don't have the funds to continue reaching the need across the state, right? Minnesota faces an estimated $12 billion in water infrastructure needs over the next 20 years to replace aging 50 to 100-year-old wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water systems. These are investments that allow communities all throughout the state to upgrade treatment plants, clean up existing contaminants such as PFAS, prepare for severe weather events, fix inflow and infiltration, and repair drinking water systems that are at or near capacity, and are often near the end of their useful life. Just last week, we held a hearing in capital investment, informational only, on the PFAS issue, and this lady came in from Michigan to talk about it, and it was really eye-opening. I think we can all agree that there is no safe level of lead in drinking water, and we are committed to removing lead service lines in every community across the state. Now, in the past 5 years, we have passed only 2 bonding bills. We are not saving taxpayers any money by not having bonding bills. Instead, these projects are getting more expensive, more costly, and at times, if they are not funded by bonding dollars through the state, these projects end up on the taxpayer through increased rates or higher property taxes, and that directly affects a family budget. Members, the needs are too great, too urgent, and too important to solve through bonding alone. Let me reiterate, this is not a in place of a bonding bill. This would supplant a bonding bill. We need new dedicated revenue sources to fix water infrastructure, and House File 3322 is one way to do that. All Minnesotans should have access to clean, safe drinking water. This is the land of 10,000 lakes plus. I hope this bill starts a conversation that will resonate with your local governments and we can work towards predictable water improvements across the state. Currently, in GOP projects alone, and I have a list here, 3.5 pages worth of projects sitting at the PFA currently. And that dollar amount is $829,022,148. That's just the loan in PFA requests from Republican members. Our bonding bill last year, for comparison's sake, was $719 million. And of course, only a fraction of that went to PFA. And after much consideration, the original bill had the MPCA as the placeholder for the funds. I thought after hearing from members, and from stakeholders, we felt that the PFA was better suited for such a program, and they are highly trusted within the communities as well as members alike, and I trust the PFA will do the work that is needed to do. With that.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know this may seem like an odd pairing here, and but I agree with Representative Franson. We have been on the bonding committee and toured around, and the demands are extremely high in terms of the cost. And we will not be able to bond our way out of this in terms of water infrastructure. I think many people in the room can remember a time before ubiquitous plastic bottles. I can remember going back and getting returnable bottles and 7-Up and other things over the years. So, I mean, do we have to have the world we're in right now? You know, consumer demand has changed things, but we don't see the cost of the true cost of the pollution. And it shows up as microplastics in our water. It shows up as microplastics in us. And those costs are there that we didn't anticipate before with the ubiquitous use of plastic bottles. Now you're gonna hear today this is unfair, it's costly, it's inflationary. We've heard all of those things for years. We've had multiple bills, as long as I've been here and probably 20 years before that, after Iowa did a deposit bill, you know, on cans and bottles. They've had that for a long time. This isn't a deposit bill. This is a tax or a fee, and I know that may give heartburn to some people, but it's a dedicated one that would go towards water infrastructure. And we need that revenue stream that could potentially do appropriation bonds as well to extend it to get the water situation in. I think a couple other things to consider is on balance, looking at inflow infiltration in addition to the PFA so that we make sure that we've got complete coverage for all the water needs. But as Representative Franson said, we're at a start here. I think there's going to be discussion in other committees as well. So we're asking for your support as we start this conversation to move forward. And we do need to do something. We have in it, and when times are particularly tight, we need to make those investments to be upgrading our drinking water, our lead service lines, our overall water infrastructure, not only for residential, but for business. We have to have that water quality to attract business. So the fee is there that pays for part of that cost.
Representative Franson.
And members, water infrastructure is critical. Bonding bills are not predictable. As I said, in the last 5 years, we've had two bonding bills, and those project increases have only become more astronomical. And so we're here to start an important conversation about a dedicated funding source, and whether it's this mechanism or something else. But that conversation must be made because our communities can't wait any longer.
Awesome. Thank you. And with that, we will go to our testifiers. First testifier I have is Chad Kolstad, who is online. Chad, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and then we have 2 minutes for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Heisman, committee members. My name is Chad Kolstad. I am the Infrastructure Unit Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm a licensed engineer in Minnesota. Today, I will be testifying on behalf of the Public Facilities Authority. As you know, our drinking water and wastewater infrastructure is aging, and the cost of replacing and updating the infrastructure continues to grow. We currently have $4.3 billion in wastewater and stormwater projects on our Clean Water State Revolving Fund project priority list, which is almost a 200% increase since 2021. Of that, $840 million of those costs are to address more stringent wastewater discharge limits needed to protect our waters of the state. On the drinking water infrastructure side, we currently have $3.6 billion in projects on the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund project priority list, which amounts to a 300% increase since 2021. $585 million of those costs are for projects needed to address emerging contaminants like manganese and PFAS, and $600 million of those costs are needed to start assisting communities with the replacement of lead service lines. As the need for water infrastructure continues to grow, we need to start thinking of creative ways to maintain our essential water infrastructure. This bill is a start of that creative thinking and would provide a reliable and consistent funding source for water infrastructure in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to take questions at the end.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next, I have Danny Locke, who is also online. Danny, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and you have 2 minutes for your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, Chair Heisman, and members of the committee. My name is Danny Locke, and I serve as the finance manager for Brainerd Public Utilities in Brainerd, Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Brainerd Public Utilities provides water, wastewater, and electric service to the city of Brainerd and its surrounding areas. In my role, I work regularly with the Minnesota PFA programs and see firsthand how important this consistent funding is for our communities in planning this major infrastructure investments. Over the coming years, our community faces several of these significant projects necessary to maintain safe and reliable water and wastewater systems. On our drinking water side, we anticipate the need for a new water treatment plant, estimated at about $51 million, a new municipal well, estimated at $7.5 million, and the lead service line replacements projected between $22 and $25 million to meet the federal and state requirements. While we appreciate the funding PFA has administered so far, Brainerd still has more than 1,000 service lines requiring replacement remaining, and without continued support, replacement is just not feasible. On our wastewater side, we anticipate approximately $42 million in near-term investments at the wastewater treatment plant and about $8 million in a lift station upgrade. And then depending on future regulatory requirements, additional treatment investments could range from $70 to $90 million in addition to these numbers. Projects of this scale are only feasible with access to PFA's low-interest loan and grant programs. These programs allow communities to move forward with essential infrastructure while managing the impact on our local ratepayers. Brainerd is not unique. As mentioned earlier, communities across Minnesota are facing rising infrastructure costs, with PFA's estimated needs indicating at least $12 billion over the next 20 years. This consistent and predictable funding for PFA programs is critical for planning for our communities and trying to maintain this essential infrastructure. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I can answer any questions at the end.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Richard Rowland.
Here, Chair.
Very good. There you are. You moved up quick. Thank you. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes, please.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Richard Rowland. I am the Deputy Director at St. Paul Regional Water Services. St. Paul Regional Water Services provides drinking water to more than 450,000 residents across St. Paul and 13 of our surrounding cities. Our system includes more than 1,200 miles of water main, a treatment facility, reservoirs, pumping stations, much which is decades old. Our overall capital needs are significant. Like many utilities across the country, we are managing aging infrastructure while investing in modern treatment standards, resiliency, and long-term reliability. Since 2019, our water rates have increased more than 50% to support critical infrastructure investments, including construction of a new water treatment plant and ongoing system improvements. We have asked our ratepayers to step up, and they have. But rate increases alone cannot meet the scale of the infrastructure challenge that we face. During the same time frame, we have responded to a public health need by building a great program to aggressively replace all lead service lines, thanks to federal and state funding commitments. We are very thankful for the past funding. By the end of 2026, we have successfully replaced more than 6,200 lead service lines. However, more than 18,000 lead lines still remain in our system, and without additional funding, we will not be able to continue this critical work. The good news is that the lead replacement program works. It's created jobs within our utility, the contractor community, and has contributed to a healthier city. Bid prices are down by 50% since we kicked off our lead-free program in 2023. Stability and maintaining partnerships with our contractor community is key. We cannot start over. Continued partnership with the state of Minnesota is critical to ensure that lead replacements do not stall. While we are second only to Minneapolis in a number of lead service lines remaining, I want to stress that this is just not a St. Paul issue. St. Paul Regional Water Services remaining lead lines represent roughly 15% of the statewide need. This is a Minnesota-wide public health challenge that requires sustained and statewide investment. We respectfully ask for continued capital investment partnership from the state of Minnesota so we can complete this important work underway and ensure safe, reliable drinking water for communities, families, and businesses that we serve. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Tim Wilkin. Opposition. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Chair Heinzman and committee members. I'm Tim Wilkin. I represent the Minnesota Beverage Association. They're the local makers and distributors of non-alcoholic beverages, and they are predominantly family-owned businesses. I also want to welcome our members who are here today. They're fittingly for our day on the Hill. We strongly oppose this tax, which unfairly and it's poor targeting and counterproductive in a year where we're focused on affordability. The bill is actually a double tax because most of our products are already paying the sales tax. So you're just adding that on top of it. For water in particular, it's a 56% tax if you go out and buy a 32-pack at your local retailer. So it's a huge tax, 56%. We are the wrong target. While the bill is aimed at to raise money to treat water for PFAS, our bottles don't contain PFAS, and they never have. Taxing innocent products while letting actual polluters, those who manufactured and released PFAS, escape accountability violates the fundamental polluter pays principle that should guide environmental policy. This misdirection is especially ironic and harmful. As the capital investment hearing last week on PFAS pointed out, the main testifier, when it came to her own well, which was contaminated by PFAS, she turned to bottled water. So when you're looking at taxing the very solution to people who are struggling with PFAS contamination, this is hitting them twice. We're an industry that takes responsibility. A couple years ago, we were here supporting the new EPR law and making sure that it was well designed and will help bring back additional materials because we want to make new bottles out of our old bottles. Our containers are fully recyclable, and our members have invested hundreds of millions of dollars nationwide in recycling infrastructure, including a very recent investment here at Eureka Recycling. Our bottles are made to be remade, and they are made by our Teamster employees right here in St. Paul, just a few miles from the Capitol here. So we urge you to oppose the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Mr. Will Hagan. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Co-chairs Fisher and Heinzman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Will Hagan, and I'm the Vice President at Minnesota Retailers. Our members range from small independent stores to regional chains and national retailers, serving customers in communities across the state. Let me begin by saying we appreciate the goal of this bill, and I want to thank Representative Franzen for advancing investments in water infrastructure, an important priority. Retailers live and operate in the same communities as our customers, and improving and protecting Minnesota's water resources and our infrastructure is something we all value. Where we have concern is with the proposed funding mechanism, the plastic bottled excise tax. As you've heard, HF 3322 creates a new excise tax on many plastic beverages sold to retailers in Minnesota. While the tax is structured at the distributor level, the economic reality is that those costs do not stay there. In a competitive supply chain, new costs introduced upstream inevitably move downstream. That means the tax will ultimately show up in the price consumers pay at the shelf. Retail operates on tight margins and intense price competition. Stores generally cannot absorb new costs like this, which means they're passed along to customers. At a time when many Minnesota families are already focused on affordability, this type of policy will increase the cost of everyday beverage products. We support the environmental goals behind this bill and the need to invest in water infrastructure, but we believe there must be a better way to fund these efforts without increasing costs for Minnesota consumers. Minnesota retailers would welcome the opportunity to work with the author and the committee to explore alternative funding mechanisms that accomplish the same goals while minimizing impacts on affordability. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any. Next, I'll move on to questions or comments from members. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say briefly that I think it's great that we're working and identifying issues with our water in a bipartisan manner. Thank you to all of the members around the committee who have signed on to my bill to replace lead service lines in the Minnesota bonding bill. It's the most expensive bill I'm carrying this year. It's $250 million, but it won't address all of the lead service line needs in Minnesota. It won't. We need more money than that. And I wish we didn't, but that is the scale of the problem, and that's because lead is a powerful neurotoxin. And I guess I would like to ask either Representative Franzen or Representative Hansen if there is any safe amount of exposure to lead, first of all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, none.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen is correct. There's no amount of exposure to lead is safe, but yet lead service lines are the number one way that Minnesotans come into contact with lead through their drinking water supply. And so the more we can do for this, the better. And so I think it's really great that we're identifying this as a need. I will also just say that plastic is contaminating our water. Microplastics are an emerging concern. They're an emerging contaminant. And everywhere we test for microplastics, we find them. They're found in the bodies of earthworms, deep in the boundary waters, wilderness area canoe, the BWCA, we all know what it stands for. Maybe I could ask Representative Falconer what exactly that acronym. But we also find microplastics in breast milk, in sperm, in our blood, in our brains. The latest research I've seen is that every American has a teaspoon worth of microplastics in their brain at this moment. So, and that's having detriments to our health. They're finding it in newborn babies. And so I think it's great that we are looking at our water infrastructure. And I just want to thank both of you for bringing this bill together. It will have an effect on human health. And I think it's a creative way to look at how we can establish this. And I guess I would just have one final question for Chair Franzen as a bonding committee chair. Can we have a day to talk about lead service lines in the bonding committee?
Representative Franson.
Well, I'm sure that could come up one of these times.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Next, I have Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, representatives, for your bill. I echo everything Representative Jordan said. I appreciate this and the work we're doing on protecting water. I know in the DE, we took out the 10-cent tax, and we heard a lot about how much cost there is. So I'm just curious if either of you or maybe Mr. Kolstad from the PFA want to talk about, you know, how much money are we going to make from this? It's hard to know. We've got 4 years in the program. What should we set this rate at? What kind of return is there going to be?
Representative Franson.
Sure. Thank you for that question. And I had heard from members that 10 cents and from, you know, from outside people that 10 cents might be a hard bill or hard pill to swallow, right? I don't have anything from nonpartisan letting us know what that revenue would raise, but artificial intelligence at 10 cents, this is just from artificial intelligence filtering out things in its own way, roughly $215 million a year. That's at 10 cents.
Representative Finke.
And it's a rough whatever, you know, so.
Representative Chair, and thank you, Representative Franson. Yes, I can take that as the ballpark. It sounds like real money. It sounds like something that, even if it's a little less than 10 cents, worth it. And you know, I just want to echo, again, what Representative Jordan said about, you know, lead is one of the problems that we have, but it's very hard to hear the plastic bottle beverage industry refer to those as innocent products, given what we know about the plastic bottle world. The world that we're living in, the pollution that we're dealing with. We need to really take this seriously, so I appreciate what you're doing.
Okay. Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Fisher. I just want members to know this is not an attack. I am not attacking plastic. I am just looking at a creative way. Maybe this is not the method for it, but it is to start the conversation of how do we clean up our water, how do we provide clean drinking water to the communities across the state.
Very good. As I look around, Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Members, just a comment. As was described by Chair Franson, I think we can all agree that this bill is a conversation starter. Mm-hmm. We know that we have significant needs. Infrastructure, specifically relative to PFA, where this goes, you know, in the coming weeks and months, the bill's being laid over. I would say that there have been really good opportunities. Just a couple of years back, and I know that we're all getting tired of hearing about what was an $18 billion surplus, but it is what it is. And Republicans are going to work towards solving these kinds of problems without raising taxes. I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Representative Franson, Representative Hansen, I appreciate you getting the conversation started. It's weird, I will have to say, that we've got both of you up here collaborating on a bill, but it goes to show to me that there's a strong interest across party lines to address the infrastructure problem that we have out there, particularly in the water world, and try and find sustainable ways to make sure that we're finding the revenue going forward. I appreciate the dedication to try to figure out how do we address the lead lines, how do we figure out wastewater, how do we take care of our aging water distribution systems that are out there. So I appreciate getting the conversation started. And with that, are there any final comments? Representative Franson, Representative Hansen will start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, we are creative people, and we're given this great opportunity to be here representing each of our districts. And I think we have the opportunity here, you know, so much in the last few days I've heard people say, well, we're not going to get anything done. I think we actually should take the opportunity to be creative and try to find our way through this. Mm-hmm. And that I'm hopeful that we can get something done. And maybe that means everybody gives a little bit and has some ideas. So I know at least we're open to, you know, hearing folks' ideas, any suggestions you have, and find a way that we can not only find the path, but actually achieve the goal here to get something passed so we can start addressing this. Because we've all been through this where we haven't got a bill, or we get a bonding bill that may not have local projects in it. So disappointment, I think we all know disappointment. So I think we should be hopeful that we could achieve something. And I think we can.
Very good. Representative Franson.
As I look at the Republican list of the projects that are currently sitting in PFA, I think these are all bills that have been introduced in the last year and last two years. Some of these cities, there's just absolutely no way that they can afford it on their own without water rates going up or property taxes being raised exponentially. And a lot of these towns are lower income cities. So it pains me that we have so many lakes in this area, but we have our citizens of the great state drinking unsafe water.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, Representative Franson, for the bill. Thank you for the co-presentation. It's great to see both sides working together. With that, I renew my motion that House File 3322, as amended, be laid over. The bill is laid over. As a quick update on the LCCMR bill, we do have work that's going on. I know that Chair Heinzman and myself have been exchanging language, and we're real close on a couple of amendments, and we're waiting for final feedback from the Office of the Legislative Auditor for other guidelines. The hope is that we'll have something for our next meeting. And with that, everyone, thank you for your time. We are adjourned.